Because Harry Potter is for little kids, too. This is MuggleCast, episode 40, for May 21st, 2006.
Aw, good job, Ryan. See why GoDaddy.com is the number one domain registrar worldwide. Now, with your domain registration, you'll get hosting, a free blog, complete email, and much more. Plus, as a MuggleCast listener, enter code RON, that's R-O-N, when you check out, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Get your piece of the internet today at GoDaddy.com. Hello, Potterites. Welcome to MuggleCast, your Harry Potter podcast for the fans, by the fans, where you bring everything from Dobby socks to your thoughts and a little bit of Spy on Sparks.
So that's what we're doing this week. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Kevin Steck.
I'm Laura Thompson.
And joining us this week,
Jess Costine.
Without further ado, let's go to MuggleCast's own Micah Tannenbaum for a look at this past week's news.
J.K. Rowling, Stephen King, and John Irving will be holding a press conference on August 1st in New York City, a few hours prior to the first benefit performance of their charity reading event. The conference will take place at 10 a.m. at Radio City Music Hall. Several actors and actresses from the Harry Potter films have been nominated for the 60th annual Tony Awards, including Ralph Fiennes and Jim Dale. For a complete list, head over to MuggleNet.com. The winners will be announced on June 11th on CBS. Reuters reported earlier this week that the Chronicles of Narnia DVD has sold 11 million copies, beating Goblet of Fire, which holds just under 10 million sales. Of interest, Narnia was released on DVD nearly a month after Goblet of Fire went on sale. And don't forget, you can find complete details on the fourth film's digital video disc on our Goblet of Fire DVD page. According to a report released by the Book Industry Study Group, publishers generated $34.6 billion in 2005, up 5.9% from the previous year. 3.1 billion books were sold last year, up 3.8% from 2004. The strongest growth occurred in juvenile books, which sold $3.34 billion in 2005. The release of the sixth book in the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, accounted for the majority of the boom. At the National Press Club's Audio Awards in Washington, D.C. Friday night, Half-Blood Prince was entered into the Audio Publishers Association's brand new Hall of Fame. Half-Blood Prince is the very first book to have been awarded with this prestigious honor. The book was narrated by Jim Dale for Listening Library. As part of her 80th birthday celebration, the Queen of Britain will hold a massive party at Buckingham Palace on June 25th to celebrate children's literature, both new and old. J.K. Rowling, along with several characters from renowned children's novels, will be in attendance. Joe will read from the sixth Harry Potter book before a show featuring dozens of the best-loved children's characters. The Daily Telegraph has opened an exciting competition in which you can win a ticket to the party, but you must be British and age 4 to 14 to enter. Dan Radcliffe has made Teen People's watch list of one of the 25 hottest stars under 25 for 2007. The page includes a small note about Dan's new film December Boys and the fifth Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. And several of the stars from Harry Potter films have been named in Netscape's list of 15 of the UK's finest. Ralph Fiennes' Voldemort came in at number 8, and Dan Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint were as one ranked 9th on the list. Clive Owen and Keira Knightley took the top two spots. Sony Pictures Classics has purchased the North American film rights to Rupert Grint's new film, Driving Lessons. No release date has been set. And finally, last October, the flying Ford Anglia used in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was mysteriously stolen from Southwest Film Studios in St. Agnes. On Wednesday, the stolen car turned up, I'm sorry about the rearview mirror, at Carnbria Castle, a 14th century stone twin tower fortress near Falmouth, Cornwall. That's all the news for this May 21st, 2006 edition of MuggleCast. Back to the show.
So we have a new face in the crowd this week. Jess, you're new to this. What do you do? What exactly do you do around MuggleNet? Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, I used to work in the fanfiction section for over a year, and since then I've been doing work on MuggleNet's gallery and other just various pages, whatever I can scrounge that the other staffers haven't already taken.
Gallery, huh? What gallery?
What gallery?
What unspeakable show. Gallery?
Yeah, the one that doesn't load on all the pages.
You heard it here first. Okay, we have a few announcements for you this week. Go ahead and buy your MuggleCast t-shirt. If you haven't bought one yet, go buy one now. Buy 12. Buy one for each member of your family, at least 5 of your friends. Just go out and buy your MuggleCast t-shirt. And we have a good reason that you need to buy one, though. Right, Andrew?
Well, right. It's really important that everyone purchases a t-shirt by Tuesday, my birthday, because National Wear Your MuggleCast T-Shirt Day is coming up on June 2nd. What does National Wear Your MuggleCast t-shirt they mean. Well, 2 weeks ago, I explained to everyone that I went to Congress, and I got this new bill signed that states June 2nd of every year is now National Wear Your MuggleCast t-shirt day. So, everyone needs to purchase their t-shirts and take a picture of yourself wearing it on June 2nd, and then we'll post them on the site, and we'll randomly pick five of them, and then they will win our Lumos 2006 shirt before it even comes out. Well, before Lumos even happens.
Yeah.
So, it's really, really, really cool shirt, and we're really excited about it.
So, yeah, everybody go out and participate. Take a picture of yourself wearing your MuggleCast t-shirt.
Tuesday is the deadline if you want to get them by June 2nd. May 26th is the complete last chance deadline. But chances are, if you order after the 23rd, you might not get the shirts in time.
So there's no guarantee.
Right.
Remember that. Okay, well, I think that wraps up the announcements. It's time for this week's listener rebuttals. Poke flutes. How do you say it?
Poke flutes.
Poke flutes awake Snorlax. They don't put them to sleep. Andrew, you care to explain?
Well, yes, I do, Ben. You were on last week's show, weren't you?
I think I got put to sleep. I don't know. I don't remember.
You don't remember the poke flutes? You were... Oh, whatever. Anyway, so last week I brought up that I was testing my Pokemon knowledge by saying that the Poke Flute would be useful in a situation with Fluffy.
Gotta catch them all.
I said something like
gotta
that.
Gotta catch them all.
Yeah, gotta catch them all. I can't remember. Forget it. So I said that Poke Flutes put Snorlax to sleep, but actually Poke Flutes awake Snorlax. I can't believe I screwed that up. I'm really sorry. I can't even begin to count how many emails we got on that this week. So thanks to everyone who emailed in with all your Pokemon knowledge.
Yep.
I should have quizzed my little brother and my neighbor that goes Pika Pika running around the neighborhood for some weird reason.
Okay, well, let's move on to our next listener rebuttal. Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm 16 and from Montreal, Canada. I was listening to episode 39 earlier, and while you guys were talking about how Harry wouldn't be able to remember anything about Godric's Hollow, a sudden realization hit me. Harry has said before that he only remembers a blinding green light. Now I'm not sure about this, but what if Harry takes the pensive, concentrates really hard on that memory, and tries to extract it? Do you think he'd be able to see a bit about what went on that night 15 years ago? And if he did, do you think there might be something that would help him find a Horcrux? Well, I think that if Harry is able to extract the memory, to preface this a little bit, psychologists say that the memories do exist and somewhere in your brain, that it's just like channeling them and being able to remember them. So if Harry's able to somehow suck the memory out with his wand or whatever and put it into a pensieve, then he probably will be able to look at it from a new perspective that he's never seen before. In terms of helping him find a Horcrux, I'm not so sure. What do you guys think?
You pretty much summed up my thoughts. I'd have to say I agree with that.
Yeah. Well, what about the Horcrux part of it? I mean,
it's possible, but
I think that would be too easy.
And there may be some clues, but I mean, not. It's not like you just see, oh my gosh, like there's one of my dirty diapers. That's a Horcrux, you know.
Yeah, but
at the same time,
how much perspective does a baby have on a situation? Because he remembers a blinding green light,
that's
but
true.
He's in a crib, so all he remembers is a crib.
Yeah.
How will that
that's
help
true.
Him?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't really see it playing too much of a factor.
The Horcrux is in
unless
the crib.
Unless Voldemort turned Harry's crib into a Horcrux.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Thanks a lot. You guys are the best. Keep up with the good work. Melissa.
Aww.
Okay, our next listener rebuttal is from Caroline from Missouri. MuggleCasters, last week you talked about if Lily and James knew about the prophecy. On page 204 of Prisoner of Azkaban, where Fudge is talking in the Three Broomsticks, Fudge says, not many people are aware that the Potters knew You-Know-Who was after them. Dumbledore, who was, of course, working tirelessly against You-Know-Who, had a number of useful spies. One of them tipped him off, and he alerted James and Lily at once. He advised them to go into hiding. So James and Lily might not have known the entire prophecy, but they did know that they were marked and went into hiding because of the prophecy itself, not just because they had survived Voldemort three times. Thanks, Caroline.
So there we go. That answers last week's
sure is a good point, though.
Question that we were asking ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's a good point about how they knew that the reason they went into hiding was because of the prophecy in an indirect way, not just because they had already survived Voldemort.
Oh, yeah.
So thanks for that, Caroline. Now moving on to the next listener rebuttal. This comes from Lauren from Long Island. Kevin used to live there. In episode 39, you were talking about Godric's Hollow and why Harry would go there, and how he knew where it was. In Half-Blood Prince, in the chapter entitled The White Tomb, Harry says, "For me, it started there, all of it. I've just got a feeling I need to go there, and I can visit my parents' graves. I'd like that." I think he is just guessing that they are buried there and hoping that also. I don't think he hopes to find a Horcrux, just that he feels he should start his search where all of this started. Thanks. I love you guys. And girl. See, Laura, aww, you were left out.
I feel left.
But anyways.
But yeah, I agree with Lauren 100%. I think that's pretty much what a couple of us were saying last week, so it's really good to see that reflected.
There was one dissenter in the group, but he's not with us this week.
We love Eric.
Poor Eric. Okay, well, that sums up the listener rebuttals.
Starting next week, we're going to try something new with our listener rebuttals. After listening to this week's show, send in a voice rebuttal for us to play in our new quote-unquote rebuttal montage. You can send these in by Skyping the username MuggleCast or calling our hotline at 1-218-20-MAGIC. Please send these to us in the form of a comment rather than a question. Rebuttal questions can still be sent in via email to mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com.
So Andrew, we reached a milestone this week, this show. Makes me so sad.
We did?
Yes. It's almost time for a midlife crisis, I'm thinking.
I'm 40.
I don't know. I think it happened earlier this week. It must be a sign. We're only going to 80.
We're 40.
40 episodes. I remember we thought 10 was a lot when me and Kevin were like, yeah, we made it 10 episodes.
Yeah.
We made it so far.
It's 40 true. Weeks is a lot. I mean, we started the show back on August 4th, and we skipped 2 weeks. So, what do you guys think?
We're gonna keep going strong.
I think we're old.
It's fun.
Well, I'm only 31.
When did you start, Laura? Episode?
Like 9.
You started on episode 9?
Or 8,
oh, really?
Something like that. So,
well, I know Eric came in on like 4 or 5, and Jamie came in on 4 or 5.
He came in the same time. Yeah, he came in the same time as Eric. Jeez, it's been quite the ride, you know.
And I don't know if we've mentioned it on the show yet, but MuggleCast 50 is perfectly timed with our 1 year anniversary of releasing the first show, which, like I said, was on August 4th.
Well, theoretically, it should be 52 if it. If it was a year.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be our 50th episode because we skipped 2 weeks. But the plan is that during Vegas, since we're all going to be there, me, Laura, Kevin, Eric, Jamie.
Just forget about me. Just forget about
me. Not Ben.
I was getting to you. We're all going to meet up in a little room, kick all the Leaky and other Muggle people out. Sorry, Jess. Are you coming, Jess?
Yep, I'm coming.
She's rooming with me. We'll be there. It's going to be awesome.
We're all going to gather into one little room. We're going to kick all the MuggleNet and Leaky people out, and we're going to record our 1 year anniversary special, episode 50. It's great timing. Only 10 more episodes. So we just wanted to thank everyone for making it through 40 episodes of us blabbing, and here's the 40 more.
We're going to keep... Here's the 40 more. My next 40 episodes, I'm going to watch my weight. Eat a few more salads and not stay up so late. Sorry. Sorry, I got a bit carried away there. Without further rambling, let's move on to this week's character discussion. It's back this week. Last week we talked about Book 7 and things relating to it, and now we're going to continue to alternate, and this week is back to the character discussion, and it's Lucius Malfoy. Just a little bit of information about Mr. Lucius. He's 43 years old. He was born in 1954. He is, of course, of Slytherin House. He's a Death Eater who is very skilled in the dark arts. According to Voldemort, Lucius always took the head in Muggle torture, something at which he undoubtedly excelled. Lucius is also an expert at manipulating people. Am I the only one who used to call him Lucius?
I did too. Yeah.
Oh no, I do it all the time.
Yeah. Lucius Malfoy has white blonde hair and cold gray eyes. His face is very pale and pointed. Lucius is a wealthy man who uses his wealth to influence people. He is arrogant, calculating, and used to getting his own way at any cost. Of course, he's a pureblood, and the Malfoy heritage goes way back. In terms of the Harry Potter books, his first mention was in Sorcerer's Stone, Chapter 5, which we've already been over, and his first appearance didn't actually happen until Chamber of Secrets in Nocturnally. This information comes from MuggleNet's encyclopedia, which part of which this article was written by Laura.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, I remember that now. I'd forgotten I'd done that. Cool.
So we have a series of questions that we want to talk about. The first one being, was Lucius the prime influence in the Ministry's beliefs on Voldemort returning? Because we all know that him and Cornelius Fudge were like two peas in a pod. And if he really wanted to, he could use his influence to say, Fudge, you know Dumbledore's way out there. What do you guys think?
I think that it's entirely possible that he is kind of another one of Fudge's puppet masters, and the fact that he sits there and tells him what he thinks Fudge needs to believe in order to benefit his and Voldemort's cause. And I think that he probably had a huge hand in Fudge's blatant denial that Voldemort had returned.
True. I think he was a factor in it, but I don't think he was the sole reason why Fudge was.
Right. Fudge was also in denial, just in general. Because,
exactly. He was, yeah.
Because he didn't.
I agree. I don't think Fudge needed much help.
He didn't choose to recognize the threat that was there. It's because he didn't want to have to deal
with it. He's sort of a ditz.
But Fudge listens to whatever anyone tells him.
Not necessarily.
Listen
to it because, no, if that was the case, then he would have believed that what Dumbledore was
Dumbledore,
saying.
Exactly.
No, but at the time, he had started.
Dumbledore is a different case.
Yeah, he'd started having his own feelings of dislike towards Dumbledore at that time. And he also was spending more time around Lucius.
But the point is, if you think about it, okay, this is the most evil wizard there has been since Grindelwald, before Grindelwald, the past century, they said. Okay, would you really want him returning on your watch and having to be held accountable for it? For example, at the opening of Half-Blood Prince, we see where Fudge sort of, it all comes back to bite him, because he has to go to the Muggle Minister, say, the bridge wasn't taken out, it wasn't taken out by a storm, it was done by giants, and stuff like that. Or, wasn't it?
Of course.
Yeah, so
on top of the fact that he doesn't want to deal with it, he's got Lucius sitting behind him saying, oh, Dumbledore's wrong. So I think that he probably had a much larger impact than we probably could have imagined at the time.
Well, yeah, and especially since, Draco's always boasting about how his father is friends at the Ministry or whatever, so
that's true, yeah.
That can always help out. We didn't really see much of Lucius in Book 6. I mean, was he even there at Hogwarts, or I don't think he was he?
No.
So,
well, I think his whole purpose in Book 6 was at the very beginning.
Right.
When he's mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think he's going to play an important role in Book 7 or a role at all?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Without doubt.
I
think he's going to get the
role. Axe. Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, I don't know about a big role concerning the final outcome of the story, but I do think that we are definitely going to find out what his fate is. It would be kind of pointless if, we had this lead up from all of the books, him getting thrown into prison, finding out that Voldemort has ticked off at him enough to assign his son a task that could ultimately right. end up, in his death, and then not have anything happen to him in the seventh
right.
book.
Mm-hmm. I feel it may just be an afterthought, though. Towards the end where Joe's wrapping all of it up, she'll say.
Well, see, the reason why I wouldn't think that is because of the way they developed him as
a bad guy?
A bad guy, exactly. Harry despises him almost as much as he despises Malfoy and Voldemort. So
From the beginning, too.
Exactly. So just a build-up to that tends to make me think that she's going to at least show him getting the axe or his role in the whole
right.
battle.
That's definitely true. And something that we mentioned with the first question about him influencing Fudge is that Lucius appears, well, prior to it being exposed that he was a Death Eater and him getting sent to Azkaban, he really had a lot of sway and power in the magical community. And in book three, we saw that he was a school governor, or book two, excuse me, that he was a school governor, and he led to like the first signs of political corruption within the ministry and all these things. And how do you think that somebody like Lucius would become a school governor?
I think that someone like Lucius would become a school governor in the same way that corrupt people do in real life.
Because of course, yeah.
I actually, where I live, we have a man whose name I will not mention, who everybody sees as this very, he's just this great guy and all this other stuff, and he's involved in all these different county activities, but he's really a big jerk. And it's like no one wants to believe it and no one wants to admit to it, but he's really mean to people and they just don't want to see it. And it's just because people don't want to admit that someone that is seen as so saintly is actually a bad person.
Right. Because he has a perception that, you know, he does his best to live up to as a respectable man. But, you know, of course, there's the people who see him for what he really is, which is a scumbag. And it's kind of hard to tell those people no when the time comes, especially since, you know, he could be torturing your family for votes or or whatever just to be a part of the school governor's mm-hmm. board.
Well, we saw it, I think it was either at the end of Goblet of Fire or sometime in Order of the Phoenix, when one of Fudge's defenses for the Malfoys was they donate to countless charities. And people do not want to believe that someone who is, say, donating to a good cause, mm-hmm. they can't sit there and say, you know, they don't want to believe that that person could be bad.
Right.
Because it's almost like it's dirty money.
Right. This is kind of funny that, you know, last week I continually rehashed the terrorism parallel. But something that's really interesting is that Osama bin Laden has donated literally millions upon millions of dollars to Islamic charities in the Middle East, which goes mm-hmm. to show that, you know, even just because you donate money or whatever, there still could be corruption there.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Well, and I mean, Osama bin Laden was trained by America.
Exactly.
We trained him, and the Wizarding World trained Voldemort. So, I mean, you see countless, I'm not sure that they're intentional parallels, but you do see a lot of connections with the corruption in government, not stating anything specific, however.
Yeah, we've seen how Lucius has been, how he is politically in terms of Cornelius Fudge and his position and abusing his position on the governor's board. But as a parent, he seems to be a vicious father, especially towards Draco. Do you guys have any idea why he's so hard on Draco?
Well, yeah, he wants Draco to be the best. I mean, isn't that the signs of, like, every parent who wants their child to be the best? They're really rough on them, and if you get a bad grade, you're grounded for weeks. And I can draw that connection to people who live around me. Like, their parents see they get one bad grade, and you're grounded, or you lose your cell phone or iPod or whatever. And by
Absolutely,
bad grade,
yeah.
I mean, like, a C.
A B.
Or even a B, yeah. It's rough, so I think that's why.
Yeah, that does explain why he would be so hard on him.
Well, to cut in, I think he also wants a suitable heir. He didn't have any other children, so this is his one shot to protect the Malfoy fortune and fame and all, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
He doesn't want Draco to just be the wayward son, no matter how good his grades are, so he has to keep the tight leash.
Yeah, that's true.
He's also making sure that Draco believes in what he believes so that he can continue that legacy.
That's that.
I think he's accomplished that.
Do you think that, I mean, we've obviously seen some faltering on Draco's part. Do you think that maybe from a young age, Draco exhibited some kind of rebellious nature towards Lucius and that's why he's so hard on him?
Well, I think it was in Sorcerer's Stone. Or maybe it was just the movie, but either in the movie or the book, Draco says that he's going to bully his father. That was in, it was in the book, actually. He was going to bully his father into buying him a broom. So it seems like there's might have always been a continuous power struggle between the two. And that may have led to why Lucius, the more powerful of the two, is being so controlling and so hard on his son.
Which is interesting, because then that means that he feels threatened by Draco.
Yeah, that's true.
So could that mean he knows something about Draco that we don't know yet?
I just think that, I mean, Draco's not stupid. we know that he's not, and I think that Lucius sees that in his son. And I think above anything, he fears his heir, you know, going to the good side or not being an active participant, you know, in Voldemort's inner circle.
So he has to give him what he wants, and he has to have respect for him.
What if Draco ends up killing his father in the end? I could see that happening. Because throughout the books, there's always been people who kill their fathers, like Voldemort killing his dad and Barty Crouch Jr. killing his dad. I don't know. I'm just saying that maybe Draco will finally be fed up with all of his dad's crap and just...
Yeah, but you have to remember Draco's hesitation at trying to kill Dumbledore.
Right, but that's because he's the only person that Voldemort's ever feared. I'd be terrified too. I mean, even though he didn't have a wand on him, Dumbledore's very powerful, and that would be... I'd be scared.
But still, can't you agree with the fact that there are people who do get brought up by bad parents, and throughout the rest of their lives, just because that person is their parent, they can't turn them away, ever? So I can almost see Draco being too scared of his father, even after he's grown up, and even after everything has happened, and, you know, whether or not he's proven himself. I could see him just always being, having this kind of irrational fear of Lucius.
That's true. However, I think by book 7... he'll have had enough time to build up the resentment towards his father for putting him in the situation where, you know, he had to flee with Snape after not being able to kill Dumbledore and having Snape to do it for him. And I think there will at least be a big confrontation between the two of them, no matter what side Draco ends up being on.
Right, but looking back on the earlier books, we talked a little bit earlier in the discussion about how Lucius has sort of become... Fudge has become one of Lucius's puppets, and basically he has a lot of influence in the ministry. And it's important to bring up that, especially in books 3 and 4, where we see Fudge station dementors around the building who are known for their loyalty to Voldemort around Hogwarts, and to bring them and to bring one with him for protection against Barty Crouch Jr. It seems to me like Lucius is another one of Fudge's puppet masters. After all, who else would want to make sure that the only witness, that Crouch Jr., couldn't testify? And it makes sense that, because we know in book 4, the Dementor sweeps in, sucks his soul out, and that's the end of it. You know that they wanted to make sure they have absolutely all the information extracted from him. Because imagine how vital of a witness that Barty Crouch Jr. could have been. Because it doesn't almost make you think that Fudge could be evil, just out of the sheer fact that Crouch Jr., he was involved in this elaborate plan to steal Harry Potter, and he can know the Dark Lord's doing, what his next move is, and it just seems stupid to me to kill him.
I don't think Fudge is evil. I think he is ignorant, and I think that he's incompetent. I don't think he had any clue
what he was doing either.
He brought the Dementor in with him.
And do you think that Lucius is the reason that he did it, though?
Yes, I think he is. I think he absolutely is, because if they had been able to make Crouch Jr. testify, then everything would have been out in the open so much earlier. And I can completely 100% see Lucius saying, you know, he's a dangerous Death Eater, you need to take this Dementor in with you. And who better for a Dementor to obey but a Death Eater who had been in Voldemort's inner circle to say, suck out his soul the minute you get in there.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. And we've continually seen Lucius's impact in terms of the ministry. For example, another tie that could possibly be made. Oh, in book 5, Umbridge mentions that she passed regulation 2 years ago at the time of Order of the Phoenix, making it nearly impossible for werewolves to find work. And this is right around when Snape let it slip to the Slytherin students that Lupin is a werewolf. All this is going on while Lucius is trying to have Buckbeak executed for school safety. Perhaps Dolores Umbridge wasn't quite as independent with all of regulations and decrees as she would like us to think. So what do you guys think? Do you think that's possible that Lucius pretty much told Umbridge, hey, this might be a good idea to to make these regulations?
I think that he definitely had a hand in some of the things that she did throughout the course of Book 5. Yes.
Well, see, the thing is I think you're giving him a little too much credit, though. Even on the account of Fudge, I don't think he was the sole purpose or sole reason why Fudge did what he did. You have to remember, Fudge is a political figure, and as a political figure, you're also taking pressure from your people. And the people don't want to believe that Voldemort is alive again.
Yeah, but the people also don't want to believe that Lucius Malfoy
exactly,
is a bad guy.
Exactly, but I think he planted seed, but he wasn't the sole reason.
I don't know. I think Lucius definitely took advantage of the fact that Fudge can be used as a pawn so easily. I mean,
yeah,
he's like a pawn in a place of power. It's really scary.
As mentioned, we were talking about the character biography for Lucius Malfoy, how he's very manipulating and he's very cool and calculating in the moves that he makes.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He's calculated, but you have to remember, even when there is political corruption, the person who's doing the corrupting is usually very discreet. He's planting seeds and he's, you know, letting people run with these ideas, but he's not physically manipulating, because when it is found out that they were wrong, he would be the person that would get the attention.
They would, yeah, that's true too. Kevin brings up a good point.
So what I'm saying is that I think that Lucius planted seeds around the ministry, but I do not think that he was
the sole
saying,
yeah,
exactly.
And another incident that happened in Book 5 was we saw that the two Dementors showed up at Privet Drive, and Umbridge took all the credit for it. Do you think Lucius could have played a role in that also? I think we might be
That's
accusing
what I'm saying,
him
yeah.
of too much. We know he's a bad guy, but I don't know if it makes sense to blame all the bad things that have happened on that one person. Do you guys think there's any connection, though?
I think he made many charitable donations to organizations and people other than organized charities. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, that I could definitely agree with. I can't say that I'm 100% either way on Lucius having had a hand in the Dementors coming to Privet Drive. I think it all really depends on how much attention Dementors would have paid to a ministry official. Because we really don't know how good their reasoning process is. I mean, can they tell the difference between someone who is not on the bad side, but they're not necessarily good, or do they just see it in a very black and white way? Like, you're not a Death Eater, therefore I don't obey you. But yeah, I'm really not 100% on that, so.
If I remember correctly, in Prisoner of Azkaban, Dumbledore made some sort of a speech where they would go after anyone, so you shouldn't give them a reason to. So I don't think they discriminate very much.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
That's true, but is that just in the case of, you know, generally going after people? Because it seems to me that they kind of sway with who's in power
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Whether or not they agree with them or not.
You have to remember,
that's definitely true.
You have to give them some benefit in order for them to obey you. That's the sole reason why they were at Azkaban, because you're giving them
something to
free
feed
people.
Off. Yeah,
exactly. You give them people and they stay there.
Mm-hmm.
But when Voldemort came back into power, he was able to provide more people.
An entire population.
Exactly. So obviously they swayed with him. I think they discriminate based upon that. They're not discriminating based upon, you know, anything other than that. They don't distinguish whether you're a Death Eater or not. They distinguish whether you can provide what they want.
Yeah.
Right.
Whether you have benefits for them. That makes sense.
Another decision that Umbridge made in Order of the Phoenix was to sack Sybil Trelawney. And you guys think that it's possible that this was a setup influenced by Lucius to retrieve the prophecy? And it would make sense, because Dumbledore is very adamant about Trelawney at least getting to stay at Hogwarts for the rest of the year. Any ideas?
that's something that I feel pretty strongly on, because it just seems like too much of a coincidence that at the beginning of the book, Draco is going on about how his father is trying to get regulations passed within the ministry to get certain teachers sacked. And then at the end of the year, conveniently, it's the woman who provided the prophecy about Harry. As for Umbridge knowing why she was sacking Trelawney, I'm not sure that she would be in on that, because I don't think that she is evil in the sense of being a Death Eater. Like Sirius said, the world is not separated into good people and Death Eaters.
There's still gray area.
Yeah, there is. There definitely is. And I think that this theory might support the fact that at one point in time, Snape did tell Voldemort who the person giving the prophecy was. Now, that doesn't necessarily define whether he's good or evil, because he could have done that at any time.
That's definitely true. Another thing is, Lucius appears to be one, well, he, at one time at least, he was one of the higher ranking Death Eaters in Voldemort's circle. Do you still think that he was really faithful to Voldemort? And it appears that he may have his own agenda for power. What do you guys think?
I agree with what Bellatrix said in the beginning of the sixth book, that if he were more loyal, he would have went to Azkaban for Voldemort.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I like that. That's really good evidence. And I've always thought that Lucius is in it for his own personal gain, just because of how he's constantly over at the ministry trying to get people to listen to what he says, and how he's, you know, constantly pushing his opinion off on others, and, you know, threatening that he's going to curse certain people's families if they don't vote to keep, or vote to, you know, kick Dumbledore out of the school. Not to mention the fact that he claimed he was, you know, under the Imperius curse at the time that he was in Voldemort's inner circle, and then all of a sudden Voldemort comes back, and he's like, oh no, I made that up, so I think...
I never denounced the old ways.
Yes, I think that he's definitely in it for his own gain. Absolutely.
That really does make sense. How do you guys think Jason Isaac fits the role of Lucius Malfoy? When we were in New York City for the Goblet of Fire premiere, after I walked out of the movie, he was actually right down the stairs, and so I had a chance to sort of mingle with him, and well, actually Sue and John were hugging him. Sue ran up there and threw her arms around him and gave him a big kiss on the cheek. But I think Jason Isaacs is definitely a good guy, and I think that he does the role of Lucius extremely well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his role in The Patriot. I thought that was a great film, and I can't remember what part he played exactly, but he was one of the bad guys. And
I thought he was the best part of that movie, really.
Yeah, he was really good. That was a great film.
I really think that there are certain actors within the Harry Potter movies, particularly the adult actors, who really just have these characters down, and they're exactly as I imagine them, and Jason Isaacs is absolutely one of those actors. Whenever I saw him in the trailer for Chamber of Secrets, I about died of excitement. I was like, this is Lucius. This is definitely who he is. And I was so pumped to go see that movie because of that. And he absolutely lived up to my expectations.
Same here.
Okay. I think that wraps up our character discussion for this week. This segment will be back in 2 weeks. I don't know what we're doing next week. Andrew, we'll have to fill you.
I know. We're going to have a party.
We're having a party. We're 41. Thanks to the two-way mirror for some of these points concerning Lucius. Now, changing pace a bit, it's time for everybody's favorite segment, Spy on Sparts. If you recall last week's show, each week Emerson decides not to answer his phone. We're going to reveal a digit of his phone number. Last week's digit was 2.
Ooh.
Let's see if Mr. Sparts is around this week.
Oh, gosh, this is so exciting. I know, I can't
contain my excitement. I can't even talk. I'm so jittery.
You can't even say it.
Oh, I think I'm going to pee my pants. Oh my god.
Come on, Emerson. Uh-oh.
Oh.
Big mistake.
That's his voicemail for all of you who don't
big
know.
Big mistake. All right. 1.
Time for the second number.
Second digit. Uh-oh. We have a call from Mr. Sparts. Hello? Hello? Hello?
You there?
Speak up, dude. I can barely hear you.
I'm inside of the building.
Oh, really? What are you doing?
I'm at the Hyatt in Indianapolis.
For what?
See Aaron.
Oh, what?
See Aaron.
Oh. By the way, you're on MuggleCast right now. We're spying on Sparts.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm dead serious. There's this new segment we're doing where each week you don't answer your phone, we reveal a digit of your phone number. And so,
really?
Yeah, last week we gave out the 2. And we already gave out the 1. So, and then you called back. So maybe we'll edit that out, but so what are you doing right now? You're visiting old Aaron?
That's actually a pretty good idea.
It's great, yeah.
Isn't that an awesome segment?
I always cancel my phone off, so you're
out of luck. Well, last week you didn't, and you just wait.
I'm going to the elevator, but it's off.
Okay, dude, I'll talk to you later.
He liked our idea.
This is debut. That's his MuggleCast debut. My life, guys, my life is now complete that Emerson has gave his approval for our segment. Oh.
Spy on Sparks is done. We always thought he didn't like it. That's why we did it.
So that was another wonderful Spy on Sparks. Well, we just threw a lot of analysis at you with old Lucius Malfoy. Well, y'all ready for some more?
Loquacious?
Lucius?
No.
You're not?
But okay.
Okay. We're moving on to our chapter-by-chapter analysis. This week is chapter 14 of Sorcerer's Stone.
So the chapter opens up with Hermione nagging Harry and Ron to get studying for their exams. And then one day in the library, they spot Hagrid looking around for what we would assume to be books. And he tells them to keep...
Hagrid doesn't know how to read.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That was one of my points.
I don't think it was ever said Hagrid couldn't read.
Well, let's get to that. Is my mind being plagued by the movie again, or did he also say in the book that I can't spell it?
Well, just because you can't spell Voldemort doesn't mean you can't read. I mean, he...
Well, you should.
Well, no,
that's
but...
a pretty big name.
Yeah, but you have to remember, not many people write down Voldemort. They write down...
He who must not be named.
You know.
You know who.
You know who, or... stuff like that, so not many people have seen the spelling of his name.
I don't know how to spell it.
Well, he had a cake for Harry, and it said Happy Birthday Harry on it. So, I mean, he must be able to read, just because he's not a good speller.
And he made it his second year of school?
Yeah, third year, actually.
He would have failed if he didn't know how to read.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Jess brings up a good point. Hagrid.
Brownie points for Jess.
Keeper of keys and games at Hogwarts.
So he tells them to keep quiet about the Sorcerer's Stone, and then they see an egg behind his back, and then Ron goes over to, investigate where he was, and they realize he was in the dragon section looking for dragon books. Well, the trio goes to, and anyone feel free to stop me.
Well, something caught my eye, and it was around at least page 231 in my book. This is a what do you call it? It's not the hardcover.
Paperback?
Ebook.
Oh, yeah.
Paperback?
Yes, paperback, sorry.
You don't know what to call it.
Yeah. Well, I don't read books that often. No, actually, I don't. Okay. It was a joke. Okay, well, what caught my eye was... Hagrid was sort of like bragging about how much Dumbledore trusted him. And I realized that we did a lot of discussion about who or what could have Dumbledore done to leave a message for Harry. Is it possible that he left it with Hagrid? The reason I say it is because he did trust Hagrid with the keys. He did trust Hagrid with Fluffy.
But at the same time, especially at that moment, when we see that Hermione can just sort of butter Hagrid up and get him to tell her things, kind of how easily manipulated he can be into giving information.
Well, I was thinking about that, but my thoughts on that was who would think that Hagrid would hold that information?
That's true. I could...
Sort of like obscurity. It's secure because no one would ever think that Dumbledore would give that information to Hagrid. The first person they would think is, you know, McGonagall or
That's
something
true.
Like that.
I could see it happening. My only grievance with it is I think it's sort of along the lines of, like, you know, who would expect to have a Horcrux in Dumbledore's office? It's like no one really would, but it just, it almost seems too easy. I don't want book 7 to be easy. I don't know, maybe I'm just mean like that, but I don't want Harry to just be able to walk around and have people say, oh, by the way, here you go.
Well, by easy, do you mean detailed and in-depth? Because, I mean, if Jo is planning on making this book shorter than, what'd she say, Half-Blood Prince or Order of the Phoenix?
Yeah, but it's still a pretty reasonable length, and it can still be detailed.
Do you mean convenient?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to be too convenient.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of things can be easy, but...
It just seems like if, you know, it just seems like if too many people who are close to Harry know what's going on, I don't know, it just sort of seems like that's going beyond what Dumbledore wanted, because...
Well, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, of course you can trust Hagrid, and of course you can trust McGonagall, but, like, when you have a good, you know, a really good group of friends, the more people you tell a secret, the more chance you have of it getting out. Not out of, you know, any act of malice, but it does happen. So I just think that a lot of stuff is going to be kept between the trio, and of course there will be some outsider information, but...
Well, that brings me to my next question. Why did Dumbledore trust Hagrid with this information when he's so gullible?
Because he said he'd trust Hagrid with his life. He trusted Hagrid with the Sorcerer's Stone. So why couldn't he trust him with this?
But that's exactly why I'm saying, why would he if he's so gullible? If Dumbledore knew Hagrid was so gullible, why would he trust him with this information?
Well, he continues to trust Hagrid throughout the entire series. He trusted Hagrid delivering Harry to the Dursleys that night. Hagrid is sort of... He may be a bit gullible, but... It's the relationship's based on trust.
But do you see my point? I mean, like, throughout this chapter, he's... Like, they're constantly, like, boosting his ego to get stuff out of him. And the whole point of the chapter is because... You know, he was gullible enough to get this dragon for information. So the questions arise, why is he so trusted when it's obvious he is like a
Can't
leaking...
Can't be trusted.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess the one thing that you can say for the fact that Hagrid leaked information to Quirrell was he was drunk. And I'm kind of hoping and assuming that that was a lesson that he learned and it never happened again. I think that one of the key points in Chapter 1 of Sorcerer's Stone is where McGonagall says, are you sure you can trust Hagrid with something as important as this? And I think the key word there being important, that when something... for instance, if it were important that Hagrid not tell, say, someone like Draco about stuff relating to the Sorcerer's Stone, he never would. But people like the trio, who obviously aren't going to run off and get him in trouble, I think he feels like he can be a little bit more open with them. And I think Dumbledore knows that. And I think he just realizes that Hagrid is on his side. And, you know, even if you've got someone who has some pretty obvious character flaws, you're not going to get anywhere if you don't have people on your side.
That's true. However, this feeds my theory that Dumbledore is an idiot, and that Dumbledore is evil, and that Dumbledore deserved to fall off the astronomy tower dead, because...
Never insult Albus Dumbledore in front of me!
Well, you know... Well, I've never liked Dumbledore. I just don't like Dumbledore. I think he's a fraud. I think he deserved everything
gosh.
He got. And
who are
you? I think almost in a way that he sets up Harry into these situations so he can't take the blame
for
you're like, whatever happens. Yeah.
I am on the verge of crying. I can't believe you would say this.
You're like the National Enquirer on MuggleCast.
It's true. While I cried. It was so sad.
I know, I laughed and took pictures while Laura cried over Dumbledore's death.
Speaking of crying, did anyone watch The OC last night?
Oh, God.
Marissa died.
Oh, God.
My sister was paralyzed for 10 minutes.
Did you watch it with her?
I was like, get a
grip.
She's
like, oh, my God.
No, I look into her room, and she's, like, on her bed, face down. I'm like, what's the problem? What happened on the show? And she's like, Marissa died. I'm like, who
oh
cares?
Oh, my
Why?
God, Andrew. Marissa died. Marissa died.
Ben, I thought you used to watch that show.
I do. I just didn't watch it this past week because I've been
busy. But it's
busy.
A season finale.
Yeah, I figured that was why we didn't do the show yesterday. I figured we were going to be too busy watching the OC.
Yeah.
Actually, I was watching it. No.
Yeah.
Ben had academic awards. Well, so the trio goes to Hagrid's hut to get more answers out of him concerning Nicholas Flamel and the Sorcerer's Stone. And later on, Hagrid sends a note via Hedwig that the egg is hatching that he has. So after it hatches, Malfoy is caught spying in on the event and runs back to the castle once they catch a glimpse of him. Now, the first thing that we wanted to bring up was, how do the owls work? Because how is Hagrid able to send Hedwig, it's kind of a tongue twister, to Harry? Like, could he have just spotted him in the sky or what?
Perhaps he's in the owlery.
Yeah, I figured it would have been from the owlery.
Yeah.
But would Hagrid have time to run up to the owlery and grab Hedwig and then mail a letter to him
there.
In the school?
Hedwig might be eating there. Getting the mouse.
But where was Harry again when this happened?
He was
Page
in the Great Hall when he got the letter, I think.
Yeah, so why couldn't Hagrid have gone into the Great Hall and got him rather than going up to the Owlery?
Because he didn't want to take a chance of anyone overhearing.
The egg is hatching.
I guess. But no one would know what they were talking about. I don't know, it just seems kind of strange, because if it's hatching, do you have time to run upstairs?
This is also
and,
the same guy who,
you know, send the letter.
Hagrid has made it very clear that he's interested in having a dragon, and then he goes into the school library and checks out books on dragons. So, clearly he...
That's true.
He doesn't
He's
always
not a very
think
rational thinker.
Though I do love him dearly.
So, Laura, you wanted to also bring up a point here concerning...
Well, whenever the trio are in the cabin with Hagrid and, you know, the egg is hatching and everything...
Yes.
All of a sudden, Hagrid looks out the window and Draco's there. And my first reaction when I first read the book was, oh God, Hagrid's dead. But then Draco found out about the dragon and he didn't spill. And what I didn't get about that was why he wouldn't want to get Hagrid into trouble immediately. And the more I thought about it, it seemed like it was possible that he might have told Lucius, who told him to keep quiet, because he was planning something within the ministry to get Hagrid in trouble, which would tie directly into the discussion about his very obvious influences on Fudge and other people within the ministry. So I wanted to see what you guys thought
of
that.
I think that's a good theory. I don't think Big Daddy Malfoy likes animals, and I think he considers giants animals. And, you know, the fact that Hagrid is a half-giant, anything to get him sacked would be perfect.
Yeah. Well, either that or manipulation. It is a way to blackmail someone, no?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on if he had anything he needed to blackmail them for. It didn't seem like he did, because all he did was kind of hang it over Ron's head in the hospital wing.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
He does seem kind of like an instant gratification person, so I do have to question his motives.
Yeah, definitely.
It's true, yeah. I don't know.
And while we're discussing this scene, I'd like to point out that in the movie, they have Norbert breathing fire right away. This is incorrect. According to Fantastic Beasts, Norwegian Ridgebacks cannot breathe fire until about 1 to 3 months, though they are the earliest fire breathers of most dragons.
Oh, but just.
Hollywood.
Yes.
It was for comedic value. Yeah. It was to get everyone to laugh. We all had a good chuckle over it.
Have you
I don't like
that
laughing. I'm mean.
No, okay. Have you noticed though that it seems like in every movie they have their certain areas in each movie where they have kind of this pattern of doing things that just I don't think are that funny. Like
wrong.
Well, in Goblet of Fire, that whole thing with the beard and Madamek seemed like eating something out of it. That was kind of icky.
Well, that was hot.
The dragon.
But it seems like they always kind of try to make. They always kind of try to make Hagrid look stupid. It almost seems like, I don't know, they try to turn him into more comic relief than I really see him being in the books.
Well, I think Hagrid's a lovable, funny guy.
I think so too.
They're just trying to set up a comedic character.
Yeah. You always have to have some goober in a film that is always some comic relief. Now, Harry gets the idea to ask Charlie if he'd like to take Norbert to Romania to be bred, because the trio is pushing Hagrid to get rid of him. They eventually get Charlie to take him back to Romania, and his friends come and pick the dragon up. Then everything's fine and dandy, everything went smooth, and then Harry and Hermione are walking back, and Filch catches them coming back to their dormitories in the middle of the night, because they forgot the invisibility cloak back up on the tower. Oh no. And that's where the chapter leaves off. Justin, you want to bring up something?
I think that Dumbledore knew about Norbert. And this is another point on my theory that Dumbledore is an idiot, because, you know, knowing about Norbert, he should have, I don't know how he would have managed it, but he should have found a way to keep Norbert. He would have been useful. Dumbledore discovered the 12 uses for dragon's blood, so he could have done some interesting experiments with Norbert.
You really like Dumbledore,
no,
do you?
No, I don't. And also, this is, he couldn't possibly have foreseen this, but it would have been, Norbert would have been useful in book 6 when they came to the cave to go for the locket Horcrux, because he could have breathed his magical fire breath and warded off the Inferi. So,
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Dumbledore has a lot of contacts, right?
Yes.
Why doesn't he just get a dragon himself?
Because then he could blame Hagrid for the dragon.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be his fault.
Okay. Conspiracy theorist.
Exactly.
Oh,
it's all Dumbledore's fault now.
Yeah.
It's always Dumbledore's fault.
Well, that wraps up this week's chapter by chapter analysis. Next week, we'll be talking about chapter 15 of Sorcerer's Stone. I don't have the book open, so I can't tell you the title.
Let me.
How could you not know, Ben? You're not a real fan.
It's a secret. They'll find out what it's called next week.
Forbidden Forest. Oh, sorry. I just ruined it. It's the Forbidden Forest. We only got, what, 3 more chapters? Three more chapters, and then we're done chapter by chapter.
Yay!
On to
We're just burning through these books.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now is the time for a segment that we debuted last week, called Give Me a Butterbeer. This is where I go on a rant about something that's going on in the Harry Potter community and say, just give me a butterbeer. But before we dive into this week's discussion, I'd first like to thank everyone who gave me feedback on the segment. I really hope that everyone who's listening enjoys this.
I don't.
I was trying to swallow, but I couldn't. Many of you requested that this week that I bring up the ongoing feud between Harry Potter and Christianity. So, let's do that. Harry haters unite. Harry Potter versus Christianity. Book burns date back several centuries. In modern times, banning has become the new burn. Copies of Harry Potter books have literally been ripped off the shelves in many schools and libraries across America, claiming that the books are encouraging the occult and evil in our youth. Just last week in Gwinnett County, Georgia, not too far from MuggleCast's own Laura, there was an attempt to remove Harry from the library. Luckily enough, the school board ruled in favor of the books. Many of the Harry haters out there dislike the Boy Wizard because of his sheer popularity. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone hit the shores of America in 1998 after taking the United Kingdom by storm. It wasn't too long but until Sorcerer's Stone took up residence on the New York Times bestseller list. When something grows to be as popular as Harry Potter, some people, particularly those who are religious, begin to question why the growth happened so rapidly. Richard Bain's book, Harry Potter and the Bible, explained the HP phenomenon as a product of the occult. Bain goes on to question the ethics of Harry, claiming that the books show morally confusing messages presented throughout the series. The main reason that Christians claim that Harry came from the occult is because of the way that J.K. Rowling thought him up. We all know that in 1990, on a train ride, Jo said that the idea just came to her, and then Harry Potter was born. Skeptics believe that Harry Potter is not a mere creation of J.K.'s imagination, but rather the occult making its way into Jo's mind. The author of Harry Potter and the Bible questions Jo's beliefs concerning magic. In an online interview, Jo said that when it comes to the kind of magic that appears in her series, she does not believe in magic in that way. This caused opponents to jump all over her, crying witchcraft. Have no fear. Joe was not referring to the occult. The type of magic that Joe is referring to is the type that exists in the minds and the hearts of the children who read her series. The magic of seeing millions of fans lining up at midnight awaiting the release of her new book. This is in no way evil magic spawning from the occult. The ethics of Harry Potter are continually questioned throughout Harry Potter and the Bible. The author makes the claim that the use of swear words like hell and damn that we see in Goblet of Fire are inappropriate for the audience that Joe is supposed to be writing for. However, the readers of the Harry Potter books have grown up along with Harry. It's preposterous for us to suggest that by the time a child is 10 or 11 years old, they haven't already heard the words hell and damn. The words add to the story in a way that oftentimes is overlooked. Sometimes, in order to express the severity of a situation, it is necessary to use words like that. It is hard to question the real lessons of the Harry Potter books. It's a classic story between good and evil, which demonstrates friendship, caring, and the power of love. Calling Joe's work unethical couldn't be further from the truth. It's an insult to those of us who read the books, and to Joe for the years of work she's put formulating the series to convey those messages. The controversy over Harry Potter is indeed going to continue. I'm not condemning parents who don't want their kids to read the books. That's a personal decision that you have to make as guardians. But attempting to censor books from youth who want to read them is a travesty and denying kids a prime educational opportunity. And most importantly, the love for reading. Jamie Fletcher said it best. Even to the present day, we often condemn books that were written to fight the very things we claim to be fighting. Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn is often cited as being racist when it was written against slavery and racism. Joe's books are about the fight against evil, not an attempt to spread it throughout the world. So, give me a butterbeer.
That was awesome. I completely agree 100%, and that was just really cool. Thank you for that.
But, you know, Ben, in response to where you're talking about cursing in the Harry Potter books, I just wanted to touch on how, with MuggleCast, we've sort of made an unspoken rule that we don't curse on the show because it's in respect to the parents who let their kids listen to the show, because the internet is such, you know, it's a dangerous place and parents are unsure. And by not cursing on the show and not using, you know, hell and damn, it attracts more people. But we don't need to curse on the show, so that's why we don't do it. But like you were saying with the books,
and it does happen occasionally.
It does. Sometimes we'll edit it out. Sometimes I just let it go once in a while. But I just wanted to say that you're right. Like with MuggleCast, it's not necessary. We don't need them to bring a point across. But like in the books, when you're working with these characters who are adults, then yes, it is necessary.
Well, I did want to make a point. Have you noted? Do any of you have a friend who does not swear at all?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you ever heard that person swear?
Sure. I mean, every now and then.
Because when they swear, it makes impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same analogy is true for the books. It's not often that J.K. Rowling uses such words, but when she does, it adds a lot of impact.
Right, and I'd like to thank... hold on one second. I got to look at the name on the box, the person who sent me this book. Because I used to have a copy of it, but then I got pissed off when I read it. Hold on. Thanks to Katie from, I think, California. She sent us a bunch of books a while back. And when I was writing up this week's Give Me a Butterbeer, I needed some of the material from people who helped cause the controversy over Harry Potter. And she sent me a copy of Harry Potter and the Bible. And it's actually so there's some interesting stuff in this book, and she left me a personal note in here saying, if this doesn't make your blood boil, I don't know what will, but it's quite interesting all the same. And it's completely true. This author went as far to rip off like some of the formatting in the book, and it just really it can really begin to irritate you because some of the points he tries to make just really get under your skin. And here's what it says. Harmless fantasy or dangerous fascination? Harry Potter and the Bible, the menace behind the magic. Then at the bottom it says, not approved by J.K. Rowling. Well, I'm sorry.
Well, no.
I'm sorry, oh, really? Mr. Baines. Your book is not receiving endorsement from MuggleCast, that's for sure.
Too late.
And you know, something else that I'll point out about swearing in the books, how parents, particularly religious parents, do not like the use of damn and hell occasionally in the books, those words are used in the Bible.
Exactly.
And I mean, children read the Bible, and it's just, I personally do not see why sheltering children from what the world is like and what they will hear in the world is doing them any favors. But at the same time, like you, Ben, I'm not going to question a parent's right to say what their child should and should not be allowed to read.
Right. And there's also a nice little parallel between Harry Potter and Huckleberry Finn. Like I said, that Huckleberry Finn is oftentimes cited as being racist, when Twain actually wrote that book to be against slavery and racism. Just because of the sheer fact that throughout the book, there's some racial slurs that are used. And just because Harry Potter uses, J.K. Rowling uses hell and damn in her books, it's not because she's doing it for the sake of cussing. That would be saying that anytime anybody swears, it's because the occult influenced them to. Which really doesn't make sense. There's no denying that those words are a part of adult conversation. And when it happened in the book, I recall, was when Crum was attempting to torture Cedric Diggory in the maze. And he said, "What the hell are you doing?" And what do you expect to say? "What the heck are you doing?" That doesn't make sense in the book. It's not real world. Mm-hmm. And that's what Joe is trying to convey.
Well, and with books like Huckleberry Finn and, for instance, To Kill a Mockingbird, if you don't use the type of language that was commonly used at that time,
it's not historically accurate. Right, and it takes away from the message.
It takes away from the story. Mm-hmm. It does, absolutely.
Well, I hope...
Also, another point, I know you brought up the point of there being witchcraft in Harry Potter and stuff like that. I believe it's probably a couple years ago now, I'm Catholic myself, and the Roman Catholic Church actually okayed Harry Potter. And the reason why is, I think it was a very good point. Just like any book, you can't take the book literally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You need to view its moral aspects, and Harry Potter itself,
right,
you know, represents a lot of good morals. So
nobody's forming a belief system off of Harry Potter.
And I think the same controversy is going on now with stuff like the Da Vinci Code and stuff like that, because people are taking it literally.
Yeah, that's
so.
It's fiction,
you know,
guys.
Yeah,
fiction.
Unnecessary.
Exactly. There's a reason, you know. It's a good story in the end, and just because it touches on things that could be potentially religious in nature doesn't mean that she ever meant it to be.
Well, let me just say one last thing. The Da Vinci Code controversy, you know, it's been getting a lot of press. And someone brought up, it might have been Tom Hanks, he was being interviewed, you know, "Whoa, why is there so much controversy?" And he said, "Well, people have to realize it's just a movie. It's not
bring down
trying
the church,
to
exactly.
bring
yeah.
a statement across. It's not saying, yeah, it's not trying to say this is what it means. This is, we're doing this
yeah,
movie because,
just...
you know, blah, blah, blah." It's the same thing with Harry Potter. Harry Potter is not trying to say, trying to imply witchcraft is evil and Harry, you know, it's just not. It doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
right.
It's
yeah,
an entertaining I story. That, yeah. That's what
it's
it
not,
is.
It's not trying to turn all the readers into little witches and wizards.
Exactly. I think the church said that we don't want people confused, and so long as they're educated to that point that it's fiction, then there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
It is under fantasy in bookstores, so...
Definitely. So, folks, that's two butterbeers down the hatch. I think I'm going to say that from now on. If you want to leave any feedback for me, send an email to ben@staff.mugglenet.com or by clicking Contact Us on mugglecast.com and selecting my name from the feedback form. I appreciate any feedback on this segment that you are willing to give. This is probably going to be one of the more controversial topics that we're going to discuss in this segment. Remember, send in some of your ideas. I may discuss them. For example, this one was – I got about 15 to 20 emails about – for feedback about the segment, and a lot, over half of them suggested that I talk about Harry Potter and Christianity this week. So I do indeed use your suggestions, so please continue to send them. So let's move on to this week's voicemails. We have a few of them for you. Let's go to the first voicemail concerning Voldemort's effects internationally.
Hi, I'm Kyle from Connecticut, and just want to say Togeflute would put a Snorlax to sleep, probably also Fluffy. Voldemort is all-powerful in Europe, and we know that he's ravished all of Europe. You think he'd also be in North America and other continents as well? And would there also be other governments for other nations as well? You see, in the Quidditch World Cup, the wizards and witches from America, would that mean anything? Thank you. Love the show. Bye.
I couldn't agree more that there are indeed, that Voldemort has indeed spread to other continents, especially North America. And a parallel that I'd like to draw here is there was a gang that got its roots in Southern California. You may have heard of them, called the MS-13. And now they've spread to an international scale. And in order for Voldemort to take the next big step, it's necessary for him to be able to spread his empire throughout the world and not just on throughout Great Britain.
Is there much fear for him right now? Like, I'm sure he's known, but do you think people in North America or in the other other continents are, like, shaking in their boots? I really don't think
I
can see it happening.
I think it's exactly the same as any other kind of terrorist leader in the real world. I mean, people here, like we've stated before, are afraid of Osama bin Laden and what his followers can do. So I think that it's perfectly rational to assume that Voldemort would be well known to wizarding communities all over the world. It just so happens that...
Is there the same fear? Because, like, with Osama bin Laden, for example, like, people in...
He attacked the U.S.
Right, and he's threatened the U.S. multiple times, like Voldemort has threatened Europe, but he hasn't threatened, say, Brazil. I mean...
But,
you know,
see, that's the thing. Voldemort doesn't... He doesn't target certain countries. He's targeting everyone. That's the point. He does not like Muggles. He does not like Muggle-borns. He is strictly obsessed with having his pure-blood society. So I really think that he's a threat everywhere. It just so happens that the books are based in England, and we just tend to see more of the European perspective on it.
That's definitely true. You know my wonderful terrorism analogy. I just love it. there's also a parallel. You know how Osama bin Laden, it's believed that there have been found out that he has terrorist Al-Qaeda cells within the United States. There was one that was broken up in Buffalo a few years ago, Buffalo, New York. So it makes sense for Voldemort to extend his empire in the same way and, you know, probably have some people out in the Americas. Because what if America tries to intervene in the magical war that's going on in Great Britain? I know that's not likely to happen in the book. It's going to be kept... You know, mm-hmm. all in the British family there, but I'm just saying that if you think about it logically, it makes sense for him to have these people out there.
Definitely. And
I do think... Oh, go ahead.
No, Laura. Go ahead, Jess.
I was just going to say that I do think he's expanded, but from the glimpse that I saw of the other wizarding communities, they seem sort of passive, where they don't really keep up with what's going on in other wizarding communities other than, you know, things like sports, you know, to use that kind of... Maybe like soccer,
you know,
football, whatever, those kind of analogies.
Yeah, that's really valid because that's kind of how it is with us too. I mean, a lot of people don't know that certain other countries exist. What was it? They said some percentage of school children could not find Iraq on a map. So, I mean, I think that there's definitely some influence there in the fact that people sort of tend to pick and choose what they pay attention to. But I think Voldemort's kind of a threat to everybody who's involved in the wizarding community, I guess. It just seems like he's such a big name in Europe that he would at least be a threat everywhere else.
That's definitely true.
I'm sure they fear him, but not as much fear as there is in England, especially among Hogwarts and Harry's closest friends mm-hmm. and family. Well, not family, but...
Yeah.
Well, that was a good question. Thanks for sending that in. Well, the next voicemail.
Hi, MuggleCast. It's Lauren from New Jersey. I recently finished reading the Da Vinci Code, and while reading, it listed the Grand Masters of the Priory of Sion, and at number 8 was Nicolas Flamel. I did some research, and Flamel's believed to have made the Philosopher's Stone, and his tomb is empty, something that was raided. Others think he achieved immortality with the stone. Why do you think J.K. Rowling would take a muggle who already existed and use him as a character in Sorcerer's Stone? Thanks.
Coincidentally enough, this book that I was reading about Harry Potter and the Bible, it mentioned that J.K. Rowling has an immense knowledge about history and archaeology, not archaeology, but just alchemy and things like that. And I think it's important to consider that the fact that he was an actual person makes him the perfect fit for the book. And I don't see anything beyond that. I don't know if he's actually a muggle, because couldn't he be a wizard?
Well, I would think within the book, he's a wizard.
Yes.
Yeah.
But within the books. Right. I'm just saying that in real life, you know, the real Nicholas
Flamel, I just thought it was convenient for the storyline.
Yeah, and it just fit perfectly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for submitting your question. Let's play the next voicemail. This one's about reading the books in different languages.
Hey guys, this is Isabel from Ecuador, and I was wondering if any of you guys have read the books in a different language. Well, I know I've read the books in Spanish, and I think I've noted a little difference. And I was wondering if you have read the books in Spanish, do you think that they lost, we can call it, a little of its magic in the process of translation? Love your show. Bye.
Como se llama?
Me llamo Andrew. Let's go around the table first. I have a copy of Sorcerer's Stone in Spanish. I got it as a, I think it was a Christmas gift, just as a little like, hey, check this out. You have it in Spanish. Cool. I never actually read it. It's over my head. How about you guys?
No tengo leer en español.
Ooh.
I have not read the book in Spanish.
Laura and Jess.
Laura, what about you?
I do have, I believe, the first and third paperbacks in Spanish. And I just thought it was really interesting that she brought that up. And I have a couple things I want to say about it after everyone else goes. So,
Jess?
I've only read them in English, but like Laura, I also have like a couple thoughts on it. I don't think the magic is lost. The story is still there. Some of the humor, I think, maybe has trouble translating, where they use metaphors and like phrases that are native to English, like, I don't know, the cat's in with the pixies now, or something like that. I did read an article that said those types of things were the hardest to translate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one of the main things that is lost, and not just in the English to Spanish translation, but in pretty much every translation, is the fact that every culture has... they have phrases and jokes that are unique to that, and it's so hard to translate that and actually have it make sense. On top of the fact that sometimes you just get translators who do weird random things and there's no explanation as to why. In the first Spanish edition, for some reason, Trevor is a turtle.
Oh.
And there's absolutely no reason for doing that. I don't know why they would make him a turtle. I just, it didn't seem like there was any benefit to be had to it. and another thing that I noticed was when they translate the Marauder's nicknames in the third one, Mooney's name is Lunatico. And when I see that, the first thing that pops into my mind is lunatic.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? And I mean, obviously you've got the connection with Luna meaning moon, but I just, to me, when I read that, it just seems like they're calling him crazy. I don't know. I just thought it was weird. But, I mean, you do still have the story.
Well, he does kind of go crazy.
That's true. That's true. He does.
It's a frenzy induced by the moon.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
That does make sense, actually. But, you know, I think that you still have the original story, but I think that it's possible that a little bit of personality can be lost along the way with the characters just because they are British. And, you know, to have it make sense to people in other cultures, you can't have them acting British or using, you know, British terms and stuff, because it wouldn't make sense.
I mean, these translations can also give additional details away. For example, RAB, I can't remember what language it was, but they needed to change one of the initials, and when it was translated back to English, it was Regulus. So it was sort of like a giveaway.
It's very interesting. Thank you for submitting your question. Hope we answered it very well. Muy bueno.
Hey, guys. This is Andrew from Chicago. I love the show. And I was just rereading book three and wondering about the possibility of Dementors playing a role in the destruction of a Horcrux. If they can suck the soul out of a person, why not be able to suck a piece of a soul out of an object? This would also provide an interesting ending to book seven for the Harry is a Horcrux shippers. Just wondering what you guys thought. Thanks. Love the show. Bye.
Terrible name.
Oh, I love that name.
It is a terrible name.
You know, Andrew means manly. There's your fun fact for the day.
But
Ben means goober. From...
Oh, what does Ben mean? Thank you for submitting your. It means son of my right hand.
Does it? What?
Andrew. Yep.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, look up. It means like Jesus.
You're Jesus?
He was the son of God's right hand.
You're the son of Jesus?
Oh, God. That's what they call Ben's them. Jesus.
I thought Jesus never... No, never mind.
I am your savior. Okay. I think that it might make sense. I think that it might make sense for Dementors to be able to suck a soul out of an object. I don't know.
The only reason I disagree with it is the fact that Dementors are drawn to people because of their fear and their emotions, and I don't think inanimate objects can have...
Yeah, a Horcrux seems dormant to me until it's used, so... I don't think the Dementors would be able to find it.
Yeah, I changed my mind. It doesn't make sense. So what if Harry was a Horcrux? Didn't Joe say Harry wasn't a Horcrux?
Yeah, she said that.
What am I?
Yeah.
Okay, then that's not going to play a role. Then.
Can people be Horcruxes? That's just, I mean...
An inanimate object.
To me, it almost seemed like it'd have to be something that... Like a coin, something you carry in your pocket, yeah. Well, that wraps up this week's voicemail discussion. Remember, call 1-218-20-MAGIC to leave your voicemail, or Skype the username MuggleCast. And finally, you can send it via an attachment to MuggleCast@staff.mugglenet.com. We appreciate any feedback and voicemails that you send to us. Let's move on to MuggleCast's favorite segment, where we bring up a topic each week and say what our favorite is. This week, it is our favorite educational degree. Thanks to Kelly for sending this in. Andrew, do you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start off. And I regrettably am not sure if this is the last one. How many degrees were there? Is it 24?
A lot.
28.
Okay, then this was the last one. But my favorite educational degree given out by the one and only Umbridge would have to be the one which ordered all student organizations, societies, teams, groups, and clubs disbanded. In other words, no clubs, no activities. I'm pretty sure no Quidditch, right? So it was a breaking point. It was you were taking away what was one of the biggest... greatest aspects of it. Quidditch. You actually took away Quidditch. It was just a school now. It was you go to school, you learn, that's it. There was nothing for students to do, and this just blew their minds. And that was one of those decrees that absolutely upset me.
I like the Quibbler one. Any student found in possession of the magazine The Quibbler will be expelled. This is educational decree number 27, signed by Dolores Jane Umbridge. This is my favorite because I think it's funny that despite the fact that you said anyone found in possession is going to be expelled, the Weasley twins put a big copy of it up, and everyone still had it. It was just, you know, on the Hogwarts Underground, which I really liked. Laura, Jess?
Well,
one of you?
I'd have to agree with you on that. I really liked that one because I am anti-censorship, and I just love the way that the students reacted to that and how... they were just sort of like, yeah, right, and they just went and did what they wanted to do anyway, and that's how I think people should react in all situations when they're being told...
Not in all situations.
No, when they're being told that they are not allowed to view certain material, I think that that is censorship, and you should be allowed to have access to all information.
Protest.
You should.
My favorite is number 29, the one Filch mentioned but was never put into action. We didn't really learn exactly what it entailed, but Filch said he would be able to hang people up by their ankles, and I just liked seeing Filch's reaction to that.
Jesse would like that, wouldn't you?
Well, that wraps up another edition of MuggleCast. Andrew, does this mean we're over the hill?
What hill?
Are we over the hill?
Are you saying we're only going through 80 episodes?
I don't know, guys.
What's going to happen in another 40? Will we be Will we be through chapter by chapter?
We might want to kill each other by the time we get to 80.
Once again, I am Ben Shane.
I'm Andrew Seams.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Kevin Steck.
Kevin had to leave a little early, everyone.
And I'm Jess Custine.
Yay!
Join us next week.
Thanks for joining us, Jess.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Jess.
You're welcome.
Join
anytime.
Us next week, where we'll be discussing all sorts of new Harry Potter related materials. I'm sorry we didn't get to Dobby Socks, like I said.
I don't remember. Oh, okay.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Or morning. Or late evening.
Hello, my name is Captain Murphy and I live in Dublin in Ireland. I just want you to know that I just bought my MuggleCast t-shirt there a few days ago and I am waiting for it to arrive and I just can't wait until it arrives. And yeah, I love this show. Listen to it every week. Keep up the good work. Bye!
Muggle Knight, you rock my socks!
Hi MuggleCast, I just like to say that I absolutely love MuggleCast and keep up the great work. I love MuggleCast, okay? Bye!
Hey, this is Brian of Virginia. Hey, Micah and all the rest of y'all. Want to say thanks for taking my mind off the repetitive actions of work. I listen to you almost every day, a couple times over and over again. Want to say thanks a lot, and peace.
J.K. Rowling, Stephen King, and John Irving will be holding a press conference on August 1st in New York City a few hours prior to the first benefit for
And he also has a 10-foot sausage in his pocket, so.
In his pants?
I was trying not to think dirty about that.
His pocket pen.
Sorry.
And as Emerson likes to say.
Oh my god.
Well.
What? Okay. Too far, Jess.
No, he actually did say that.
That is a direct Emerson quote.
Tonight's podcast is rated PG for mild Jess.
Sexual innuendo.
This is Andrew Sims' little brother, Ryan Sims. Here is an Andrew Sims fact. Did you know Andrew Sims cannot whistle? Join us next week for another exciting fact about Andrew Sims.
Keepers of keys and games at Hogwarts.